creating a learning society. A new approach to growth, development, and social progress. Authors Joseph E. Stiglitz and Bruce C. Greenwald. A learning economy. A learning society perspective takes a very different view of growth and development strategies from the standard neoclassical approach in several respects. It begins by focusing on the knowledge embedded in individuals, firms, and in society, more generally, and how that knowledge changes, is transmitted, and is put to use. Knowledge, like information, is asymmetric. From the perspective of the individual, an advance of his or her knowledge is simply knowing something that he or she had not previously known. While the consequences of information asymmetry have been extensively explored over the past 40 years, the consequences of differential knowledge have not. Creating a dynamic learning society has many dimensions. Individuals have to have a mindset to learn. Knowledge is created by individuals, typically working with organizations, and transmitted to others within the organization. It is then transmitted from one organization to another. The learning revolution. One of the advances in modern economies has been improvements in the processes which they learn. They have learned how to learn. There is not a single breakthrough that led to enhanced learning capacities, but rather a series of organizational innovation. Consistent with this, subsequent work identified the greater part of such progress as arising from the continuous accumulation of small improvements in production processes rather than from dramatic technological breakthroughs. Though some, perhaps many, of these small improvements may be based on or related to transformative changes. The role of government in promoting a learning society. The financial crisis has called attention to the role of the government in crisis prevention. Widespread environmental problems have called attention to the role of government in preventing pollution and potentially catastrophic climate change. These are examples of government's role in preventing negative externalities. The production of knowledge entails positive externalities. The private sector produces too much of goods that give rise to negative externalities, which is why government must either impose charges when firms generate pollution-generating activities or otherwise regulate pollution-generating activities. By contrast, the private sector typically produces too little of goods that give rise to positive externalities. The private sector produces too much of goods that give rise to negative externalities, which is why government must either impose charges when firms generate pollution-generating activities or otherwise regulate pollution-generating activities. By contrast, the private sector typically produces too little of goods that give rise to positive externalities. Again, to correct this market distortion requires some form of government intervention. Macroeconomic perspectives. There are several empirical arguments that can be brought to bear to support our conclusion concerning the importance of learning. The first is a simple argument. In theory, leading-edge technology is globally available. Thus, with sufficient capital and trained labor, or sufficient mobility for capital and trained labor, all countries should enjoy comparable standards of living. The only difference would be the rents associated with ownership of intellectual property rights and factor supplies. Yet, this is an enormous divergence in economic performance and standards of living across national economies, far greater than can be explained by differences in factor supplies. And this includes many low-performing economies with high levels of capital intensity, especially among formerly socialist economies, and highly trained labor forces. Learning capacities and learning to learn. Not only do firms and societies differ in their ability to transform input into output, they also differ in their ability to learn. Some individuals, firms, and countries are quicker at picking up changes that have occurred elsewhere, discovering knowledge that might be relevant, and adapting technology to their circumstances. Learning by doing. How much we learn by doing is affected by how we do what we do. If we consciously experiment on the job, looking for alternative ways of doing what we are doing, we are likely to learn more than if we passively wait for the eureka moment, when we have a brilliant insight about an alternative way of doing what we have been doing. Technological knowledge is embodied in machines, and a machine constructed for one purpose can often be adapted for quite another. New machines can also be a catalyst for learning. Computerization provides an important example. In the process of computerization, firms had to rethink their business operations, to codify much of what they had done without thinking. Through that process, they came to learn, to think about how much of what they could do could be done better. Learning from others. We also learn from others, both in formal education and, even more importantly, in everyday contact with others. Knowledge is embodied in people and is transmitted by contact among people. Workers move from firm to firm, and thus convey some of the learning that has occurred in one firm to those in others. Cognitive frames. Individuals and firms have to adopt a cognitive frame, a mindset that is conducive to learning. That entails the belief that change is possible and important and can be shaped and advanced by deliberate activities. Part of the reason for the relative stagnation in living standards that persisted for thousands of years before the industrial and learning revolutions was that there was not this cognitive frame. Localized learning. There are many aspects of learning spillovers. Learning is localized. It affects production processes that are similar to those for which there has been learning more than it affects production processes that are markedly different. Improvements in a capital-intensive process of making textiles may have little impact on hand loom technology, but the learning is not limited to a single process and related processes for a particular product. Innovations in one sector may benefit seemingly unrelated sectors. Because the production of any good involves many stages, and some of the stages may involve processes that are similar to those used in another seemingly distinct sector. Bureaucracy and innovation. Rules and procedures often hinder change, and change makes the implementation of rules and procedures more difficult, for they have to be constantly adapted to changing circumstances. There is thus a natural conflict between the two. But bureaucrats also perform important social functions, for example, in regulating externalities. Intellectual property rights, the pool of knowledge, and innovation. Advocates of stronger intellectual property rights, or IPR, ceteris paribus, argue that stronger intellectual property rights lead to higher levels of R&D, and therefore more innovation. But empirical research provides at best ambiguous support for a simple relationship between the strength of intellectual property rights and the level of innovation, or even higher levels of investment in R&D or learning. The reason is that much is hidden in the assumption of ceteris paribus. There are many other ways of appropriating returns from research, and thus incremental benefit from stronger IPR. At least in many industries, is less than it otherwise would be. IPR in the relationship between social and private returns. Given our emphasis on learning externalities, it might be thought that we would support the conventional wisdom that the younger the intellectual property rights, the better. For at least with strong intellectual property rights, it would seem that more of the returns to the innovation would be captured by the innovator. This would reduce the gap between social and private returns. However, the distortion introduces into the economy system by IPR into two categories. 1. IPR gives rise to static inefficiency. 2. Inappropriately designed IPR regimes may even impede the pace of innovation. Alternatives to IPR. Advocates of stronger intellectual property rights give the impression that they are essential for innovation. A moment's reflection should make it obvious that there are many alternative ways to finance and reward innovation. There are, for instance, other ways of appropriating returns from innovation, such as trade secrets, first mover advantage, besides patents and copyrights. And in many areas, these are highly effective. In fact, as we have already noted, many of the most important advances in knowledge are not protected by intellectual property rights and were not motivated by monetary gains. The basic mathematical advances that provided the underpinnings of the computer and the discovery of DNA, which underlies so many advances in modern medicine, are among the following: government-funded research, open source, and prizes. To sum up, knowledge is a free good. The biggest cost in its transmission is not in the production or distribution of knowledge, but in its assimilation. This is something that all teachers know. One of the advantages of trade is that it facilitates the spreading of information of technological knowledge. The fact that there is a contact, that ideas are flowing, leads to spillover effects, learning, and greater competition.